Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 5th of February, these are our main stories. The US Democratic Party finally releases early results after a disastrous caucus in Iowa. People in the Chinese city of Wuhan struggle to get treatment as the new strain of coronavirus continues to spread. The United Nations says more than 500,000 Syrians have been displaced by fighting in Idlib province. Also in this podcast, scandal in Lesotho as the First Lady is charged in the murder of the Prime Minister's previous wife, and a fibre that really is man-made.
This yarn is made out of human cells, and this is a material that's very strong.
Scientists in France say this human yarn could one day be used to repair organs and tissues. We begin in the US. It took a while, but the Democrats have finally begun releasing results of the Iowa caucus, the first leg of the party's presidential candidate selection process. At the time of recording this podcast, it appears that Pete Buttigieg has the early lead, with Bernie Sanders not far behind. The outcome of this contest should have been clear 24 hours ago, but the vote counting was derailed by technical problems, a situation that President Donald Trump described as an unmitigated disaster. On Tuesday night, the chair of the Democratic Party in Iowa spoke to the press.
How can anyone trust you now?
We have been working day and night to make sure that these results are accurate. The one thing I will say is that the underlying data, the raw data, is secure. It was always secure. This was a coding error in one of the pieces on the back end, but the raw data, the data that has come in, is secure.
That was Troy Price. Our correspondent Nida Taufik is in the Iowa state capital, Des Moines.
This is very important. The Iowa Democratic Party has put out reporting from 62% of the precincts, but crucially, those are from all 99 counties around Iowa. So there was concern whether they would just be putting out some of more of the urban areas and not some of the rural areas, but they are reporting across the state, but still a third of the results still not in. But with what the data that we have, it shows that Mayor Pete Buttigieg is in the lead, followed by the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Pete Buttigieg had 26.9% of the vote, Sanders with 25.1% of the vote, followed by Elizabeth Warren at 18.3% of the vote, and then Vice President Joe Biden down in the fourth spot there with 15.6% of the vote. So again, as I say, these are just estimates from the data that's in so far. But certainly we heard from Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders yesterday declaring victory. It seems like their internal numbers have matched what the Iowa Democratic Party is putting out.
I think that would have to be a big disappointment for Joe Biden, who a lot of people see as one of the favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Joe Biden went in aggressively in Iowa, even putting out an ad saying, don't take a risk on another candidate. He said nobody else can go in from day one and call any world leader and expand the agenda from the Obama years as well as he could. And he argued that he could get independents for other Republicans, crucially moderates, a real broad coalition together in the country with African Americans and other minorities. What the voters of Iowa said, and this is a majority white state that's not very representative of the nation. But what Iowa voters said is essentially he is not the one that they think is best placed to beat Donald Trump. And that is a key concern for Democrats this time around because they are anxious to get President Trump out of office. But Joe Biden, his campaign saying that it's not just about Iowa, that he will be competitive in South Carolina and later Super Tuesday, where the majority of delegates are at stake.
Nida Taufik. It's been more than a month since a new strain of coronavirus was detected in the Chinese city of Wuhan, and the illness continues to spread. But the World Health Organization points out that only 1% of all diagnosed cases have been outside China. On Tuesday, the WHO's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, praised Beijing for its containment efforts and promised that more help was on the way.
WHO is sending masks, gloves and respirators and almost 18,000 isolation gowns from our warehouses in Dubai and Accra to 24 countries who need support. And we will add more countries. We're sending a team of international experts to work with their Chinese counterparts to increase understanding of the outbreak to guide the global response.
Wuhan remains the epicentre of the virus, and while work crews have rushed to build new health facilities, residents are still struggling to get the care they need. Wen Jun Wang lives in Wuhan. She spoke to the BBC's Razia Iqbal with the help of a translator.
We are a family of five. My parents, my brother and my uncle's family live together. I have my own family and I live separately. Since the outbreak of the coronavirus, my uncle has already passed away. My father is critically ill now, and my mom and aunt have started showing some symptoms, and the CT scan shows their lungs are infected. My brother is coughing too and has some breathing difficulties.
After your uncle passed away, tell me, Wenjen, are your mother and aunt and father in hospital or are they in their home?
They are at home. My dad has a high fever now. His temperature was 39.3 yesterday, and he's constantly coughing and having breathing difficulties. We bought him an oxygen machine at home, and he relies on that machine 24/7. He's taking both Chinese and Western medicines at the moment. There's no hospital for him to go to because his case hasn't been confirmed due to the lack of testing kits in the hospitals. My mom and aunt walk to the hospital every day in the hope of getting a bed for my dad, despite their own health situation. But no hospital would take them.
Would you say that you are being supported by the authorities because there is no hospital bed for your family members who are clearly struggling? Are you getting the help that you need from the authorities?
Well, the situation here now in Wuhan is there's many quarantine points to accommodate patients who have slight symptoms or who are still in the incubation period. There are some simple and really basic facilities there. But for people who are critically ill, like my father, there are no beds for them. My uncle actually died in one of the quarantine points because there are no medical facilities for people with severe symptoms. I really hope my father could get some proper treatment. But no one is in contact with us or helping us at the moment.
Wen Jun Wang speaking to Razia Iqbal. In Syria, thousands of civilians are being driven from their homes as the civil war rages on. The United Nations has estimated that more than 500,000 people were displaced in the last 2 months alone as Syrian government troops, backed by Russia, launched a fresh offensive to capture the rebel-held province of Idlib. That's in addition to the 400,000 who had already fled from the fighting. David Swanson is a spokesperson for the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He spoke to the BBC's Tim Franks.
Obviously, the UN is alarmed for the safety and protection of the over 3 million civilians in Idlib and surrounding. Some 520,000 women, children and men have been displaced from their homes, and the vast majority of them are women and children.
And of course, this is happening in the middle of a pretty harsh winter, and presumably with the safe refuge that they can find diminishing as well as this offensive continues to make its progress.
Absolutely. I mean, what we have had is that whole towns along the frontline area of southern Idlib have virtually been emptied as an increasing number of civilians flee northward to areas deemed safer. This is a particularly difficult situation right now because you have crippling, bitter cold nights and heavy rains and sandstorms. So it's a particularly dire circumstances for these people that have recently been displaced to live with.
How are you getting aid to them, given what we're getting reports of, which is that the offensive is not abating and that some of the bombardment that is going on appears to be fairly indiscriminate?
Well, the crisis in northwest Syria further underscores the critical role of cross-border assistance from Turkey. I think it's important for people to realize that without this one critical modality of assistance, we would not be able to get assistance into this area at all. Many of the frontline responders in this area, they themselves have been caught up in the violence and they themselves have seen their families displaced, which is making our ability to respond to this particular emergency particularly challenging.
I know, given that you work for a UN agency, David, you wouldn't want to be drawn into calling out particular actors or particular countries. But given that this is far from just being an internal conflict, that there are big powers involved, in particular at the moment, Turkey on the one side, Russia on the other side, what is the message that is going to these countries, these governments, about the need, we've heard it so many times, but the need to de-escalate somehow?
I mean, the bottom line is the consequences of this ongoing violence is having on the millions of people living in Syria today. We're talking about a crisis that's now coming up to 9 years now. We now have near-daily violence that resulted in undue suffering for hundreds of thousands of people displaced over the past 9 months, living in appalling humanitarian conditions. And we continue to call, as part of the UN and on part of the humanitarian community, for a complete cessation of hostilities. And we completely urge all parties and those with influence of them to ensure the protection of civilians and bring this conflict to an end.
The UN's David Swanson. Now, listen to this. That's the Sri Lankan national anthem sung in Tamil, the country's second official language. But at the annual Independence Day celebrations held in the capital city of Colombo on Tuesday, the government dropped the Tamil version of the song and instead only played a version in the majority Sinhala language. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Itarajan reports.
The previous Sri Lankan government included the Tamil version of the national anthem in the 2016 event as part of a push to heal the wounds of the nearly three-decade war between the Tamil Tiger rebels and the Sri Lankan military. The brutal conflict ended with the total defeat of the Tamil Tigers in 2009. The current president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, came to power last November on a Sinhala nationalist campaign. Critics have condemned the move to drop the Tamil version as a setback to reconciliation efforts after the end of the civil war.
And Barra Senator Rajan. A stunning political scandal is unfolding in the South African country of Lesotho. The First Lady, Maesaia Tebane, has been charged in the murder of the Prime Minister's previous wife, Dipilelo Tebane. Our Africa Affairs editor, Mary Harper, told my colleague Tim Franks about the case.
We need to go back until 2017, which is when the previous wife of the man who was about to become Prime Minister, Thomas Tebane, she was shot dead outside her home in the capital, Maseru, just 2 days before Thomas Tebane was inaugurated as Prime Minister. And at that time, they were estranged. They were involved in very bitter divorce proceedings. And Thomas Tebane was already with the woman who is now the First Lady. And so this caused absolute uproar when this happened in Lesotho. But earlier this year, it was made public that the police commissioner had written a letter saying that phone records showed that a phone call was made from near the scene of this murder involving the telephone number that was attributed to the Prime Minister, Thomas Tebane. So the police also have spoken to him. When they said they wanted to speak to his wife, she fled and went to South Africa. And so they then issued an arrest warrant for her and she returned on Tuesday and has been charged with murder.
So she handed herself into the police. In terms of the Prime Minister, you say that the Prime Minister was questioned. He has not been charged, just to be clear.
The police say that eight others have been charged and that some of them are in Lesotho and some of them are in South Africa. But as far as we are aware, no names have been released. The Prime Minister Thomas Thabane, who has been questioned by the police, he has subsequently said that he will resign. He hasn't said when, but he said that that's on the grounds of age. He's 80 years old, so he's making no link to what happened to the first wife. He's just saying that he is going to resign because there's been a lot of criticism of him, both from the opposition, but also from his own party and from the public.
Mary Harper speaking to Tim Franks. Still to come on the podcast, new temperature data for January shows parts of Northern Europe were 6 degrees warmer than average. And are golfers getting too good? Officials say some of the world's top courses are too small to contain golfers' powerful drives. In France, prosecutors have opened an investigation into claims of rape and sexual assault of minors in figure skating after allegations were made against a famous coach. The probe was announced after Sarah Abitbol, a former world championship medalist, said her coach had subjected her to what she described as horrible things, beginning when she was a young teenager. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield told me how these allegations came to light.
The main allegations are from a woman called Sarah Abitbol, who back in the day was a very well-known figure skater. She's now 44, but back in the 1990s, 2000s, she was several times French and European champion in figure skating. She is going back to her youth, when she was 15, 16, 17, and in a book, she's come out with this allegation quite clear that she was raped and sexually abused over 2 years when she was 15, 16, 17 by a man who we know was her trainer, a man called Gilles Beyer. He's admitted to an inappropriate sexual relationship and apologised for it, but says that her account is not entirely the way he remembers it. In any case, what Sarah Abitbol has done is begin to pull aside a curtain on what some people say is a much wider problem of abuse back then on young figure skaters by their trainers, who were all official trainers in the French Ice Skating Federation.
This has caught the attention of not just the French public, but of the prosecutors, if you know, and politicians as well. What is the reaction in France?
Quite clearly, it's striking a chord because it is very much of our time, this, isn't it? I mean, we've here in France recently, we've had allegations in the world of film, in the world of literature. Women now in their 30s, 40s, 50s coming out and saying, back then, I was abused, I was raped. And, you know, the Me Too movement, of course, lies behind all this as well. So it's very much in line with all of that. And people are fascinated. They're taking it very, very seriously. The government is taking it very, very seriously. The minister of sports, Roxana Marassignano, has summoned, I should say, the head of the Ice Sports Federation and asked him to resign on the basis that he's been in the job for 20 years. He should have known this. There's a lot of suspicion that he did know about it and that there has been a certain amount of covering up of pals at the top of the federation. He hasn't gone, but he's certainly under pressure to leave. And there is certainly a feeling that there may well be more to come.
And Hugh, how will this investigation now proceed?
Well, I mean, there will be a judicial investigation. I mean, it's what's slightly unclear is how far it can go, given that there is a statute of limitations attached to most of these alleged crimes. In other words, they happened so long ago that nobody could be prosecuted for them now. But in French law, as I understand it, there's now a provision very much set up in reaction to these allegations of historic sexual abuse that there is a judicial investigation which may not lead to a prosecution but can still take place simply to elucidate the facts. And there are others who've been named and spoken to the French sports newspaper L'Equipe last week who have similar stories. All these stories will, I imagine, come out in this investigation, and some of them may lead to prosecutions if the alleged crimes took place sufficiently recently.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. New global temperature data published for January has revealed that last month was 0.03 degrees Celsius warmer than average. Figures unveiled by the European Union show that temperatures across much of northeastern Europe were an unprecedented 6 degrees above average. Richard Howells has more.
Winter in Europe, particularly the north, should be cold and icy. One village in western Norway had a record temperature at the beginning of the month of 19 degrees Celsius, more than 25 degrees higher than it should be. Other parts of Scandinavia and Western Russia also experienced a much warmer January than normal, but parts of Canada and Alaska were colder. The last 5 years have been the hottest on record, and carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere are now at their highest in nearly a million years.
Richard Howells. It is the ultimate human-made fibre, a yarn grown from human skin cells, and it could soon be used for tissue grafts or repairing organs. A team from the University of Bordeaux in France has said surgeons would be able to weave pouches, tubes and valves out of the new material. Nicolas Leroux led the work and spoke to me about the potential the yarn could have.
This yarn is made out of human cells that produce a material that we're all made of, which is called the extracellular matrix. So it sounds complicated, but many people know one of its components that's well known, which is collagen. So the cells that we grow in the lab can make this material that's, let's call it collagen for simplification. And this is a material that's very strong. It's as strong as some of our own tissues. And it's made by the cells in a way that once we put it back in the human, the patient's immune system will completely accept it like its own. Because this extracellular matrix is the same in your body, in my body, unlike the whole organs that are recognized with specific markers that are specifically yours or specifically mine.
Is this a completely new invention, or have you been working on this or on similar methods for some time?
It's been my life's work, basically. So I've worked a lot on this material before, but it was, well, it is still produced as a sheet. And, you know, there's so much things you can do with a sheet. It's a very slippery material, like meat. It's a lot like handling meat, so it can be very slippery. It's very, very flexible. So the change now is that we found ways to make yarn out of these sheets. And once you have a yarn, now you can do everything that you can do in the textile industry. So which is knitting, braiding, weaving, basically do whatever you want.
Yeah, I saw a picture and it does look remarkably like you've been knitting in order to create this. How quickly could it be used?
This is a very revolutionary approach because these are produced in the lab with cells. So from a regulatory point of view, it's quite complicated. So right now we're in the stage where we test the feasibility of building tissues and implanting them in animals. And once we've assessed for a specific application that it works well in animals, we can start asking for approval to do it in humans. But, you know, realistically, it's at least a 10-year path.
Nicolas Leroux from the University of Bordeaux. Today's elite golfers are just too good, or at least too good at hitting the ball a very long way. Nowadays, top golfers can hit their tee shots an average of 280 metres compared with 250 metres in 1995. Two of the sport's governing bodies are so concerned about the effect of high-tech equipment in golf, they fear the game's future is under threat. Our golf correspondent Ian Carter has more.
Golf courses are becoming too short to properly test the world's best players. Using powerful drivers and aerodynamic balls, elite players such as Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy can hit their tee shots an average of 310 yards. This compares with 278 yards in 1995. Now the rules makers, the St Andrews-based Royal and Ancient and the United States Golf Association, have said that measures need to be taken to put limits on these distances. Their joint report concludes that golf can only prosper if this continuing cycle of ever-increasing hitting distances and golf course lengths is brought to an end. The RNA's chief executive is Martin Slumbers.
As hitting distance has grown, particularly on golf courses that can't extend any further, then holes can become overpowered. And hitting distance, as against even hitting accuracy, becomes a predominant factor. And we think that deep down the traditions of the game are about a balance of skills.
For limits to be brought in, the authorities will have to win over golf equipment manufacturers and the professional tours who've always been sceptical about the need for change. As in athletics, where modern shoe designs are making runners go faster, this may lead to clashes between sports businesses and governing bodies.
Ian Carter. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.